Crouch. Bind. Set.
Joe presents the House of Rugby, together with Guinness.
Ladies and gents, welcome back to a new edition of House of Rugby Shorts, brought to you by Joe, together with our very good friends at Guinness, as always. And those of you who've tuned into Shorts before will know it's shorter, sharper, less Hask, less Tins, a lot more rugby chat as a result. A gentle 20-minute canter around the course. And this time around, we're a little closer to home because we are talking to the assistant manager of London Scottish, at home, of course, in the Championship right now. And we were just debating, is it Burnett or Burnett? But we're going to go with Burnett, Liam, just to, I suppose, not upset your granny, but just stick with the roots. She likes Burnett, but you're Burnett. How are you, first of all? How are you getting on?
Yeah, I'm good. Lockdown's been a bit weird. I mean, for me in particular, because I'm on furlough, but my other half isn't. So she's working every day. So I'm finding myself having to go and kind of walk around Richmond Park and just get out of the house for a couple of hours. So I'm not sort of disturbing her.
Tell me a little bit about your rugby background and your rugby story and how you've ended up at Scottish.
The rugby story, it's one of these ones of, much like many a player, dreamed of this sort of professional player when I was younger. But I mean, I was a half decent player, went through kind of Edinburgh age groups and things like that and flirted with the national like junior setup and stuff. But
what position were you?
Prop, believe it or not.
Strong.
I was versatile because my uncle taught me to play, because I was never the biggest. So he taught me to play on both sides, but also taught me the sort of dirty tricks on how to manipulate people twice your size and things like that. Because he ended up playing for Scotland himself. So he knew all the dark arts.
You've got great pedigree in your family, haven't you? Tell me a little bit about those in the family who've represented and played at a high level.
So my grandpa, he played kind of top level rugby in Scotland and played one capped game. And then my dad and my uncle both played for Heriots, which probably doesn't mean an awful lot, but they were, so back before professional rugby, Scottish rugby teams actually did okay. And they would play like your Harlequins and teams like that. And they won the kind of what we now call the Heineken Cup or the Champions Cup at Twickenham. 79, I think it was. So,
right.
And then uncle capped for Scotland, dad was Scotland B, and then played in what is frustrating for him because now they're all capped internationals. But whereas obviously games before, it used to be tour matches against sort of New Zealand, South Africa, and then like the Five Nations / Six Nations now that were capped, everything else. So he's played against like Romania and a few other countries for Scotland, but it doesn't count as a capped international.
Amazing. And they weren't part of... There's that fabulous story. I know we're digressing. There's that fabulous story about Scotland playing Romania. So I've got a real love for Scottish rugby because I went to university in Edinburgh and I had three or four very happy years at Edinburgh Accies, which I know will make you... In fact, funny enough, I was telling producer side before we started recording this, I played against Scottish once. We meant to come down on the train and it was snowing. So we ended up getting a sort of 11-hour bus journey, arrived 5 minutes before kickoff, and I think shipped 80 points to Scottish. So it wasn't the greatest of days, but it was a lot of fun nevertheless. But the story I was going to ask you about, Scotland against Romania, have you ever heard the one where one of the players went out through the trapdoor in the Tron in Edinburgh?
Vaguely, yeah. I think
it's one of the great stories. The guy called Norrie Rowan, who played prop for Scotland.
Yeah, there's a name I recognise anyway. Yeah.
I bet you do. And Norrie owned a pub in Edinburgh called The Tron.
Yeah.
And Scotland played Romania. And can't remember get the guy's name. I wish I could Google it quickly. They went to The Tron for the post-match knees up. And the second row leant across the bar and said, look, I really want to escape from the regime as it is at the moment. And I'm looking for diplomatic immunity. And Norrie said, brilliant, come behind the bar. And they stuffed him down a sort of trapdoor in the bar. He went through the vaults in Edinburgh, which you'll well know sort of, you know, lead everywhere and anywhere, escaped onto the street and ran up to the local policeman and said, I'd like to claim diplomatic immunity. And at the end of the night, obviously the secret police who were standing outside so no one could come in or out, went in when there was a player missing and he'd gone by that point. I think he ended up playing sort of top flight rugby in Boroughmuir or someone like that. I don't know why I'm telling this story. We're meant to be talking about you, but it is a great story of Scottish rugby.
Now that you say it, it's a story my dad told me because he worked at Murrayfield as well for quite a while. So he was the medical director pre James Robson now. So
right.
He was kind of, he led into where we are currently. So he was, and it is a story he told me, but then some of the stories of Scottish rugby are just unbelievable.
Brilliant. I'm glad we're off to a running start. Let's try and get back on course. So in terms of obviously lots of rugby pedigree in your family, great ability, etc. Why, I mean, do you ever look back now and wonder perhaps why you didn't make it to the very top?
I can put my finger on it straight away. Laziness. As sad as that is, because in hindsight, that kind of 15, 16-year-old period would have put the work in the gym and done the weights and done the necessary S&C. Because that, for me, was my downfall, was just hated that side of it. Just wanted to train, just wanted to play.
I was just going to ask you, Liam, about, I suppose, some of the achievements you did have. You went on tour to New Zealand, which was a pretty brutal place to go. But tell me about some of the memories, I suppose, you know, you did enjoy and the learning process you went through, I suppose.
That year, 2002, when we went to New Zealand, that was an exceptional year for me because school-wise, we'd reached the Scottish equivalent of the Daily Mail Cup, so the school's cup final, like that year, and that was the first time in school history. And bear in mind, this is a school that had like Scott Hastings, Gavin Hastings, and all the rest of it. We were the first team to do it. It was amazing. And playing over there and playing, I was chat to producer Si and was kind of trying to remember because I couldn't find it on my laptop, but we wrote down a list of every player that we played in the four schools that we played and guys that went on to Super Rugby. I said three from Auckland Grammar, but I think it was two from Auckland Grammar that were all blacks. Wow. Then I think 20-plus players across four schools that went to Super Rugby. So astonishing to think I've played against those guys. But
yeah,
it wasn't actually kind of... I mean, the last game against Auckland Grammar, so like Ben Atinga and guys like that playing and a very, very strong side. I mean, they've produced 50-plus All Blacks, I think.
Yeah, something like that.
It was a phenomenal game. We started, went 5-0 up, then shipped 89 points. It was one of those thinking, oh, here we go. This could... No, it really wasn't.
You've got to finish it with the first punch because otherwise you get a bit of a rabbit attack back.
Yeah, if the game was 90 seconds long, then we'd be flying. But
so tell me more about sort of how you've ended up in the role that you're in now.
So day-to-day, week-to-week, it's kind of... it varies every week, but a lot of it is assisting the first team manager / operations manager, whatever his job title is these days, with stuff to do with like the RFU, processing players and they're getting stuff ready for a game day. And then a lot of it is like the actual game day stuff, basically splitting the job that rather than him doing it all on a match day, it would be kind of split between the two of us. So not some of the less exciting bits on game day, like the GMS for the RFU and dealing with referees and the opposition and then fifth official, which is always fun.
What is fifth official? Is that holding up sub numbers? And
the RFU provide us with the three on the pitch and then the fourth official for things. But as a requirement for the championship and the premiership, certainly, you're required to provide a fifth official, which is basically all of the match stuff on a paper form, which I don't quite understand because you fill in GMS and you email the RFU.
What is GMS? Forgive my ignorance.
The game management system.
Oh, it's there.
It's essentially just a log of everything that happened in the game. So if there's a yellow card, what was it for? Reasons. Kind of mind numbing, to be honest, but it needs to be done. It's a bit laborious on game day, but a necessary evil, if you will.
And how did you end up doing that?
I'd been playing a bit for Scottish. I'd been down for a couple of years and then I thought it was calling me almost. So played a bit in the amateur setup. And then early 2017, they put an advert out. So I thought, well, it's in the blood. Why not? I'll apply for it. At the time, it was meant to be quite sort of minute in what it was. It was really just game day. But then I've expanded it myself and gotten a proper... like working sort of contract and job description type thing rather than just two lines that were put on the Scottish website at first. So it's interesting because obviously with game day being anything from a Friday night to Sunday afternoon, it's quite good having the other full-time job that actually can be a bit more flexible because if you're traveling back from Pirates after a half-two kickoff on a Sunday, you're not getting back to Richmond till midnight, 1 o'clock, whatever. So being able to sort of have the flexibility to say, can I have Monday morning off or I'll work later and work sort of flexible hours is definitely very handy.
Which is the best away trip?
A lot of people would say Jersey. Jersey's a good one if you've got, I know Ealing do it and some of the other, we used to, but we now just fly out the night before, stay, and then we'll fly back almost immediately after the game. Jersey's a good one if you've got the Saturday night. So you play the game and you're staying and then you're not flying back till Sunday. That is a cracking trip. And then Pirates, It's nice when you're down there.
Yeah.
But God knows, like, for the rest, because we're bad enough being with stops and stuff. You're probably about 8-9 hours on the coach down to Penzance. So yeah. Teams like Bedford and Doncaster and things, you think this, they almost have to leave a day early just to get there in time. Because my understanding is most teams anyway would do, apart from possibly Ealing, but most teams, I believe, travel by coach to most fixtures. So
yeah. I'll trade you a story. So I obviously had 15 years at Sky and used to cover a lot of the Championship, actually. And one of the greatest, often asked, what's the greatest away day? We had some incredible days in France and New Zealand, Australia, etc. Genuinely, one of my favourite ever trips was 4 days in Cornwall for the British and Irish Cup final between Pirates and Munster A. 4 days in Newquay, acclimatising, and our show was 30 seconds on air on the red button on Sky. So it wasn't even on a main channel. 30 seconds on air, 2 minute half time. And we said goodbye under a sort of a billboard. There was nothing in vision or anything at the end. There was no deep. We just crashed off air. And it was 4 days surfing and, yes, acclimatizing in inverted commas for probably about 2.5 minutes work all in. But sometimes you got to make the most of these trips. I mean, is that very much the ethos at Scottish that, you know, if you're on the bus and you've got a game to play, that, you know, it's one in, all in kind of thing? Or because particularly now you're going sort of part-time, are you going to find players coming at different points and making their own way, etc., because of jobs and the like?
My assumption anyway at the moment is that we'd still be kind of an all-for-one type mentality. You might find that the only time that sort of people are mixing and matching is maybe like games if they can't necessarily do a Sunday because they can't get Monday off work or so. But I'd like to think, based on kind of the model that Richmond, etc., use, it tends to be you find a job that's flexible enough that it kind of allows you the rugby weekend, as it were. And that you'd assume that now more than ever, we really need to be keeping that one club type ethos and keeping everyone together, because obviously it's harder for the coaches and the DOR, etc., because you've got far less kind of contact time. We used to be based at the Lensbury, where I know like England Sevens and things are. That would be there kind of four mornings a week plus two afternoons and so on. And you were there quite a lot of the time, whereas now it's a bit trickier because you're only really talking 3 evenings a week. So you're probably talking 4 to 6 hours worth of contact time.
Tell me about the decision to go part-time. I imagine, is that purely financial?
It is, yeah. It was pretty much down to, kind of, it was a mixture of the RFU funding cuts coming in and then obviously COVID hitting, so the situation just kind of plummeted. So it was a necessary thing because our budget just couldn't cope, because like several teams in the Championship, the English qualified player money that the RFU paid, which is what they cut, was pretty much a good chunk of our playing budget. So you take away 100,000, 200,000, whatever it comes down to in the end, you're taking away a kind of significant amount of, I think the main thing is our benefactor / owner, he wants the sort of long-term stability of the club. So sees it as a sort of necessary evil of put us to part-time now. The long-term view is we will be back to full-time training, because obviously with Mr. Griffiths from the ex-Saracens and all the rest of it, who's been...
Edward Griffiths.
That was it, yeah. Who's put in charge of kind of revamping the champ and making it like a viable product and things like that. We're hoping that bears fruit and then it becomes a kind of more sustainable model. For me, I think long term, the sustainability has to be, but it's whether you get the buy-in from the Premiership, it's been the A-League, because who really, if we're honest, wants to go and watch teams play on a Monday night in the A-League? It kind of speaks volumes as well that we had, I think, in total of 5 guys play for Queen's A on a Monday night because they didn't have enough players themselves within the squad because of injuries or whatever. So we ended up giving them 5 players to play in their A team. And you think, well, if that's the case, then why don't you scrap it, link every Premiership team up with a Championship side and give them 15 loan players for the season? They can be younger guys that are coming through, sort of looking to progress, but surely they learn more playing in a sort of more competitive champ environment than they do in the A-League. I think that's how you sort of see, how I see it longer term, is that you, if you bin that off and then pair everyone up, if you like, ourselves with Quins or Saracens or whoever, but like you pair them off and then you give academy guys and kind of fringe players a run, that then reduces the budget for ourselves, Bedford, Richmond, whoever, because you're only budgeting potentially for 25 players and you're then supplemented by loan players.
We've done 92 shows, I think, Liam, and that 2 minutes is about the most sense that anyone has spoken in any of those shows. I cannot tell you how much I agree with you about the need to grow the Championship. I couldn't agree with you more. I don't get the A-League. I don't understand the point of it.
Yeah.
And I cannot see, you know, and there are some far more qualified people than me out there who are questioning the roles of academies, etc. The game is at a point now, and the sport is at a point now, where people need life experiences. And actually growing up in academies and playing in front of empty stadiums on Monday night just isn't beneficial to anybody, I think, in the long run. I could not agree with you more on that need to get young players into a proper club that has an entire season. And, you know, we had Jack Knoll on the other day. He was talking about how much he learned playing for, I think it was Redruth.
Yeah.
You know, at the age of 16. I know that Michael Liner's son, Lewis, is currently dual registered with Richmond and is having an amazing season there. He has absolutely ripped up trees, but will be learning way more in amongst men and, you know, and in a proper club environment than he would do just training with another 15, 20-year-olds in Guildford or wherever it is. So, yeah, you've got a backer here, wherever the petition is. I'd be happy to sign it. I mean, because I remember hearing years ago that the Premiership might buy the Championship and that the two were going to come together, as it were. And yet it feels at the moment that the gap is bigger than it's ever been.
No, I'd completely agree. And I think, but then like the idea of like the loan players as well, you need to be sending them for half a season or full season to get. So like, because we've got contrasting examples from the season-ish that's just gone. So we had a player on loan from Worcester who was there pretty much pre-Christmas and then till we stopped March time. And he really well integrated. Guys had given him a nickname and things, and you could see his progression because he was getting better. Whereas earlier on the year and last year, we had a couple of guys on loan from Quinn's, Sarri's. They came in for a game. They trained with us twice, came in for the game, then went back because they were going for Premiership Cup. And you think, how does that work? Because we've been sent some very talented players, but at the same time you're going, yeah, but they don't gel with any of the boys, and they're just going back to, because they have an off week, so it's like, oh, well, you may as well get some rugby. I don't really see the point in that. So you almost need the Premiership teams to want to buy in a bit more and find that link and sort of say, okay, even if it's not the obvious links, so like you don't link us with Quinn's, Richmond, Sarri's or something. If you linked us with Worcester or you linked us with the Falcons, it's the same principle. It's just the only team that it would cause issue for is Ealing, because they've obviously got dream of Premiership rugby themselves and are well backed. So that potentially throws a spanner in the works. But
so that was the article I read. And again, I'm lacking the detail, but I remember you almost could set your stall out at the start of the season, which was, if you'd like to go for promotion, build your squad and run your squad and own your squad. If you are, and the reality is there are a lot of clubs in the Championship who are comfortable at Championship level and don't have the infrastructure and don't have the backer to grow beyond that, then you can open yourself up for, you know, loan players, you know, who can come in and A, get great experience, but also contribute to the club and to life on and off the field. And I thought it was a brilliant idea. I can't remember where I read it or who I read it from. And I will throw out an open invitation, and you'll forgive me for doing so at this point in time. If someone knows why the A-League is more important than the Championship, please come and tell us. And I'd love to chat to Ed Griffiths about plans for the Championship as well. So perhaps we might be able to get him on for one of these. Talking of life experiences, there are one or two fairly high-profile players who might be picking up some life experiences next season as Saracens come to the Championship. Does that fill you with excitement? Does it fill the players with dread? What is the sort of reaction to Sarri's in the Champo?
Generally, the reaction's good. If you can't test yourself against the best players, what's the point type thing? I think from a off-the-field perspective, thinking about it, I think it'll do wonders for the Champ as a whole, because actually you could potentially have, if we average, say, 1,200 at the Athletic Ground for, and then more when we play Richmond. But if you've got a game again, a home game against Sarri's, and you can potentially throw an extra 2,000 people on top of that, that does wonders, just that one game, for kind of finances and the profile. Because if you've got guys who perhaps live in Richmond and don't like go to Twickenham for England games and their rugby is kind of Premiership rugby on the TV or whatever the case may be. If we're playing Saracens and they see Farrell, etc. playing, and they rock up to the athletic ground and think, oh, actually, this was quite a good fun rugby day. They might come back and we build potentially like more people wanting to come, because that's part of the problem in the Championship as well. You have a set bunch of fans per team. And certainly in the case with Scottish, but I've noticed it with other clubs as well, it's a kind of more of an ageing population. So it's guys who have probably supported the club since they moved to London, maybe they grew up in and around it or whatever, or Bedford or whoever, but they're all pushing on, and there isn't that next generation of kids coming through to watch the game, other than maybe like the minis who come with their dad and things. There's no, whereas a Premiership team, well, in our area, we've got a lot of the students will just migrate to become a Quins fan because they're here for 3 years. It's on their doorstep at St Mary's. They're a Quins fan and that's it. And then they'll kind of stay with Quins. They might not go to as many games if they move out of the area or whatever when they leave university, but actually they're then captured as a Quins fan, if that were.
Yeah. It's very interesting, isn't it? I mean, can you give me a synopsis as to where the ambition levels are with Scottish at the moment? I mean, you mentioned the benefactor, but you know, what is the grand plan?
It's up in the air. There seems to be, depending on who you speak to, I mean, obviously long-term ambition is stay where we are and back to kind of having a thriving professional club. But I would say I'm not sure that our ambition lies necessarily with the Premiership. I think we would like to get a higher level, because with the higher level, you can, especially being a London club, you can generate kind of higher revenues and whatever else. But I don't know if that is explore, like Ealing sort of muted the idea of Pro 14 in an expanded version, / if they get rid of South African teams or whatever the case may be. But I think there is definite ambition there. It's just we're somewhat hampered at present by sort of financial situation more than anything else. But what I love about us is we kind of thrive on the fact that we haven't got anywhere near the biggest budget in the league, but yet we get some big wins. Like we took 5 points off Pirates at home in the league. They were close to Ealing in second. Obviously Newcastle were kind of run away, but Pirates weren't a million miles away in third. Went to another well-financed club in Coventry, and if it weren't for the last-minute bounce of a ball, but the ball bounced over the line and gone in a touch, we would have won, because we were 30 points to 29 up, and then they unfortunately scored to take the win. But we're that close, but yet, if you looked at it in budgetary terms, you'd be thinking, we shouldn't be anywhere near some of these boys. Yes, the ones in and around us, kind of Richmond, Bedford, etc. But like some of the teams at the top that we take the scalps off, we shouldn't be anywhere near. And I love that, because it's the kind of dig-in, dogged attitude. And people know that they're not the best played players in the champ, but we build a spirit that everyone buys into. I love it from that perspective.
Which is brilliant to hear. It's great to hear of a thriving club. And actually, Harry Payne, aged 8, my boy was down at, there was a minis tournament the other day, and we were all down at the Athletic Ground. It's a great club with a great soul, London Scottish. Just, I suppose, a couple of quickies to finish with. Can you see anybody getting near Sarries next season, or do they sort of, can anyone drag them into an arm wrestle or surprise them, or is it going to be a lot of a little 5-pointer to start with and then 89 points coming back the other way?
Sadly, I think, I mean, you look at Newcastle, and they were, 18 points clear before this break happened. No disrespect to them, but they're even a kind of fractured Saracen side with players going here, there and everywhere on loan for the year. There's no competition there. Even if he kept Farrell in the team and then put 14 pub blokes or whatever in a round, I think they'd still give most teams in the league a hiding, to be honest, but we shall see.
Yeah. We shall indeed. Do you know, the other thing is, I know they've got it wrong and they are paying their penalty, but I reckon they'll be very good ambassadors in the Championship as well. I think they will embrace it and make the most of it. And I hope they, you know, they take the opportunity that is there. I'm sure they will do. And just, I suppose, what does the next few weeks, months look like? Where are Scottish in the return to play?
Non-existent at the moment, unfortunately. Right. It's going through the medical personnel in the champ just now. The original dates were, we were looking at kind of pre-season in July, etc. But a lot of it obviously hinges on theoretical start dates, because if the Premiership restarts in July, August, for a team to win it, obviously you're talking 11 weeks at a minimum. Obviously, yeah. 9 for Saracens and so on. And I don't see it being an option where they can... So, because someone said the other day, feasibly you could have Saracens playing in September in the Championship, finishing the Premiership and finishing off the European Cup. Now, that's just not, it doesn't work. They might have enough of a squad that they could play two games on the same day, but for me, that doesn't work. So it might be controversial. I think with what's happened with COVID, I think it's leading us slash the RFU perfectly into the global season. How that affects the champ, I don't know, because that would mean players haven't trained or played since March, going into a season starting in January, theoretically, which is a long, long time. But from a Premiership perspective, it almost leads into it perfectly. Finish the current season, give them 5 weeks off, start pre-season again in December, January, and then in you go, ready-made global season.
Happy days. Perhaps we'll get some good out of this after all. And just a final question. We'll give you a chance for a bit of a plug. You know, we've mentioned the mini section and you know, we mentioned the fact that Scottish is a club with a great soul and a great heart. But, you know, for people in the area, for people who perhaps want to go touring the country, why Scottish? Who should we look out for? And what kind of a welcome can they expect at the Athletic Ground?
You'll get the warmest of welcomes, rugby-wise. We're unique in the sense of we don't have music blaring to come out into the pitch. We still have the piper who pipes the team out onto the pitch. So there's you're talking 1878, so we're a very old club with a lot of tradition. So it's really... And the thing is, as well, as you know, going to university in Edinburgh, Scottish are some of the nicest people you meet. So we might not put our hand in our pocket for a pint.
But I was going to say, yeah.
It's just a warm welcome all round, generally.
Yeah, I was going to say, very, very nice, except on Calcutta Cup Day. Listen, good on you. It's been really nice to have a chat. And, you know, I hope the future of your club is happy and healthy. And I hope the future of the Championship, likewise, is resolved to a point that it becomes the league that it could and should be. And I think at the moment there are huge challenges in the game, obviously. But, you know, hopefully a thriving Championship can only be a good thing for English rugby. So it would be a great goal to sort out. Look after yourself, Liam. Lovely to have a chat. Very best to everyone. We shall keep a keen eye on how it goes over the next few weeks and months for you and for the club as well. And we will leave it there for this week. Thank you, as always, for watching and for listening to House of Rugby Shorts. We're a podcast and a YouTube show, as you know by now. And that's where you're going to find this week's main episode, a wonderful episode with the fabulous Will Carling on captaincy at 22, World Cup finals, playing Joe Nelomo in 95, and also struggles in retirement. It was highly emotional at times, that one, and well worth a watch if you haven't already. Don't forget, you can also dip into our entire back catalogue, and that's available on both mediums. We've also got a very popular Facebook group, and there's our Instagram page as well, at Rugby Joe, and you can download the new interview podcast series Sports Pages from iTunes or your podcast app. Thank you once again to Liam Burnett. Granny won't be happy, but we certainly are. Good luck in the Championship. We'll be back next Wednesday with a full house of Hask, Tins, and a very special part two with Nigel Owens. Till then, have a great weekend from all of us. Bye for now.
You've been listening to the House of Rugby on Joe, together with Guinness. Drink responsibly. Visit drinkaware.co.uk for the facts.